Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
Without you, we are done. The world will not know what is happening here because the twists and turns of a man that knows nothing more but to tweet his hate away will take over. And we cannot let that happen. So it's on us, but it's on you. Because after all, we're one nation.
An appeal from San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz, 1 month after Puerto Rico was devastated by Hurricane Maria. Most of the island's 3.5 million residents still lack electricity. Food and water remain in short supply. We'll get an update from independent journalist Rosa Clemente just back from the island last night. And as Puerto Rico faces an estimated $95 million in cleanup costs, we'll look at a major new investigation into exactly who owns its $74 billion debt. Then to California, as wildfires scorch more than 200,000 acres, roughly the size of New York City, more than 11,000 firefighters are battling the blaze. A number of them are prisoners.
The only way you would tell that I was a prison firefighter is if I told you. On the line, you wouldn't know at all.
The incarcerated women who fight California wildfires. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge in Hawaii blocked most of President Trump's latest version of a travel ban Tuesday, just hours before it was set to take effect. U.S. District Judge Derek Watson, who previously blocked plans by the administration to ban refugees and travelers from six majority Muslim nations, ruled the latest ban, quote, plainly discriminates based on nationality, unquote, in violation of the law, as well as the, quote, founding principles of the nation, unquote. The ban would have barred some travelers from Chad, Iran, Libya, North Korea, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. However, the Hawaiian judge, Watson's order, will allow a ban on some North Koreans and Venezuelans to go into effect. The Supreme Court was scheduled to hear arguments this month on an earlier version of a travel ban, but canceled the hearing after President Trump issued new restrictions. The White House has vowed to appeal the latest ruling. On Capitol Hill, two senators said Tuesday they've reached a deal to stabilize health insurance markets as President Trump wages a campaign aimed at undermining the Affordable Care Act. The limited deal by Republican Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee and Democratic Senator Patty Murray of Washington will fund health insurance subsidies for low-income Americans for 2 years. President Trump said he would back the deal, even though he said last week he was ending billions of dollars in federal subsidies to insurance companies, part of his effort to, quote, let Obamacare implode. In Florida, the widow of U.S. Army Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, Maisha Johnson, wept over the casket of her husband as his body arrived at Miami International Airport on Tuesday, ahead of a funeral planned for the weekend. Sergeant Johnson was one of four U.S. soldiers killed in an ambush during a patrol in Niger on October 4th. A raid that President Trump did not publicly acknowledge until a reporter confronted him about it this week. On Tuesday, Florida Congressmember Frederica Wilson said Trump called Maisha Johnson as she was accompanying her family to the airport in a car. The congresswoman said she heard Trump say over a speakerphone, quote, he knew what he signed up for, but when it happens, it hurts anyway, unquote. In response, Wilson told the Miami Herald, quote, I think it's so insensitive. It's crazy. Why do you need to say that? You don't say that to someone who lost family, the father, the breadwinner. You can say, I'm so sorry for your loss. He's a hero. I'm livid, Wilson said. Trump stirred outrage Monday when he falsely claimed President Obama did not personally call the families of U.S. soldiers killed in combat. The comment prompted former Obama deputy chief of staff to call the claim an effing lie while blasting Trump as a, quote, deranged animal. On Tuesday, the president doubled down on the claim in an interview with Fox News Radio.
To best of my knowledge, I think I've called every family of somebody that's died, and it's the hardest call to make, and I said it very loud and clear yesterday. The hardest thing for me to do is do that. Now, as far as other representatives, I don't know. I mean, you could ask General Kelly, did he get a call from Obama? You could ask other people. I don't know what Obama's policy was. I write letters, and I also call.
Trump was referring to his chief of staff, retired Marine Corps General John Kelly, whose son, First Lieutenant Robert Kelly, died in 2010 in Afghanistan when he stepped on a landmine. Kelly has previously refused to discuss his son's death publicly. The Washington Post reports John Kelly attended a 2011 breakfast held by President Obama for Gold Star families. In Somalia, new details about Saturday's massive truck bomb attack reveal an accused mastermind of the attack may have been motivated by a deadly U.S. raid last summer that left 10 civilians dead, including children. The Guardian reports the suspected bomber is from the specific community targeted by the raid last August, a village near the capital, Mogadishu. Saturday's attack killed more than 300 people and left more than 400 injured. In Afghanistan, a string of Taliban attacks on Afghan security forces Tuesday left 80 people dead and nearly 300 injured. In Afghanistan's worst day of violence in at least 5 months, in the deadliest attack, Taliban fighters used a series of bombs to breach a police compound in the city of Gardez, entering the building and setting off an hours-long gun battle. In Kenya, opposition leader Raila Odinga called off a protest campaign on Tuesday after three people were shot and killed by police as they demonstrated against Kenya's election commission. With the latest deaths, human rights groups say at least 67 of Odinga's supporters have been killed in protests over a failed election on August 8th. The incumbent president, Uhuru Kenyatta, won that election with 54% of the vote, but Kenya's Supreme Court nullified the results, citing irregularities in Kenya's electronic voting system. Odinga said last week he would not participate in a revote scheduled for October 26 without electoral reforms. Israel's army raided TV channels and media outlets across the occupied West Bank overnight Tuesday, confiscating equipment, forcing broadcasters off the air, arresting two Palestinians. In a statement, the Israeli Defense Forces accused the media outlets of inciting terrorism. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate condemned the crackdown and promised to rally media workers outside UN offices in Ramallah. The raids came as Israel approved plans to build 31 new housing units in a settlement in the Palestinian city of Hebron. It's the latest move by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to defy international law by expanding Jewish-only settlements. This is Hagit Ofran of the Israeli group Peace Now.
This plan is going to be in the heart of the Palestinian city of Hebron. It's going to increase the number of settlers by 20%. This is a bad decision that Israel is now allowing to expand the settlement which represent the most ugly face of Israel's occupation.
Newly declassified documents reveal diplomats at the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta, Indonesia, knew about and supported a mass extermination campaign by Indonesia's government in the 1960s that killed hundreds of thousands of civilians and, by some estimates, more than a million people. Beginning in 1965, the Indonesian military and paramilitary forces slaughtered accused communists and dissidents after overthrowing the democratically elected government. That military was backed by the administration of President Lyndon Johnson and led by General Suharto, who would go on to rule Indonesia for decades. Memos made public on Tuesday, U.S. Embassy officials cheered reports describing the slaughter and indiscriminate killings of Indonesians. One memo from late 1965 read, quote, "Generally, victims are taken out of populous areas before being killed and bodies are buried rather than thrown in river," end quote. Historians have already established the U.S. provided the Indonesian army with financial, military and intelligence support at the time of the mass killings. Back in the United States, President Trump's nominee for drug czar, Republican Congressmember Tom Marino, withdrew from consideration Tuesday after a Washington Post 60 Minutes investigation found he led a drug industry-backed effort to weaken the federal government's ability to crack down on the opioid epidemic. The bill, backed by Marino, made it nearly impossible for the DEA to keep large quantities of prescription opioid pain pills off the black market. In a tweet, President Trump acknowledged Marino was withdrawing and called him a fine man and a great congressman. In Los Angeles, a fire erupted overnight at a massive Chevron oil refinery near the Los Angeles International Airport, lighting up the night sky and sending huge columns of smoke into residential neighborhoods. Police warned nearby residents to close their windows as firefighters spent about half an hour extinguishing flames. Chevron describes the site as the largest oil refinery in the western United States, processing more than 250,000 barrels of crude oil each day. Meanwhile, in Northern California, a new wildfire erupted in the Santa Cruz Mountains southwest of San Jose Tuesday, the latest in a record-setting fire season. The official death toll from the fires has reached 41, the deadliest in California history. Dozens more remain missing. And according to Sonoma County Sheriff, some victims were reduced to ashes and bones and will never be identified. In Texas, the American Civil Liberties Union says the Trump administration is barring a pregnant, undocumented teenager from getting an abortion. In a lawsuit in federal court, the ACLU says a 17-year-old girl who's living unaccompanied in a refugee resettlement shelter has been granted permission from a judge to terminate her pregnancy. But officials with the Department of Health and Human Services and other agencies have refused to transport her to a women's health clinic for an abortion. California Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill that will allow residents to claim a third gender when applying for official documents. Beginning in 2019, anyone applying for a driver's license or birth certificate will be able to identify themselves as female, male, or non-binary. The legislation follows similar bills that passed in Oregon and Washington, D.C., with other states, including New York, set to follow suit. In Chechnya, a Russian man who says he was kidnapped and tortured by police has become the first openly gay witness to describe what human rights groups are calling a gay pogrom carried out by Chechen officials. 30-year-old Maxim Lupinov told reporters Monday he was abducted on the street in the Chechen capital of Grozny last March, taken to a bloodstained jail cell where he was tortured for 12 days.
This cell was really scary. It was about 2 by 2 meters, and a quarter of the cell was simply covered in blood. It wasn't blood from yesterday or the day before yesterday. It was fresh. It just soaked into the floor. First, they were beating me with plastic pipes. I cannot say exactly for how long, but it was long. I was falling down on my knees because I could no longer stand my feet any longer. My legs, my thighs, buttocks, back were all beaten. They would let me take a breath now and then, but afterwards pushing me back up and resuming the beating, shouting threats and accusations.
Human rights groups say as many as 100 people, mainly gay young men, were swept up by Chechen police and tortured earlier this year. Back in the United States, the White House is denying an explosive article published in The New Yorker that reports President Trump joked that Vice President Mike Pence wants to hang gay people. According to reporter Jane Mayer, Trump made the comments in a private meeting with a legal scholar, saying of the vice president's views on LGBT rights, quote, "Don't ask that guy. He wants to hang them all," unquote. Trump also reportedly mocked Pence over his religious views and his anti-abortion activism. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders told reporters the remarks never happened, but The New Yorker stands by its reporting, saying the report was meticulously researched and based on interviews with over 60 officials. And in northern Minnesota, a district court judge in Hubbard County has ruled he will allow activists to present a so-called necessity defense when they go to trial on charges for turning off valves to an oil pipeline in a direct action protest last year. The activists, who say their decision to break the law was necessitated by the clear and present danger posed by climate change, will be allowed to call expert witnesses on climate change. Among those who may be called are former top NASA climate scientist James Hansen and 350.org founder Bill McKibben, who told the website Common Dreams, quote, "The whole planet will be inside a single courtroom the day this trial begins. It's a rare chance to explain precisely why we need to act and act now, McKibben said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We begin today's show in Puerto Rico, 1 month after it was devastated by Hurricane Maria and before that, Hurricane Irma. 4 out of 5 Puerto Ricans are still without electricity, and food and water remain in short supply. Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rosselló, has set a goal of reestablishing electricity to 30% of the island by the end of this month. Meanwhile, on Monday, the island's Secretary of State, Luis Rivera Marín, posted a shocking video of himself standing in a large dumpster where he claimed to have found food and water that had been discarded instead of distributed.
Look, this is the food of the people that we should be distributing to Puerto Rico. We are seeing a whole pallet of boxes of food. We're going to do an inventory of this. This is water, the water that the people need. We're going to see what explanation they have to give us, because this makes even the eyes of God cry.
As Puerto Rico struggles to rebuild, we turn now to a major new investigation that examines the looming question of what will happen to the island's $74 billion debt that's owed to bondholders, as it faces an estimated $95 billion in storm-related damage. Reporters at the Center for Investigative Journalism in Puerto Rico and in these times in the United States spent 5 months digging through court filings and documents from financial firms and much more in order to put together the most up-to-date list of 10 of the largest financial firms that are now scrambling to get billions of dollars out of the bankrupt island as it tries to rebuild. More than 30 known financial firms are vying for Puerto Rico's debt repayments, of which at least 24 are so-called vulture funds that specialize in high-risk assets and cater to wealthy investors. Several of the funds were complicit in past financial crises in other parts of the world, including in Argentina and Greece, as well as during the 2008 financial collapse in the United States. After President Trump visited Puerto Rico earlier this month, he told Fox News his administration would help the island recover from the extensive damage caused by Hurricane Maria by possibly wiping out its massive debt.
Well, we're going to work something out. We have to look at their whole debt structure. You know, they owe a lot of money to your friends on Wall Street, and we're going to have to wipe that out. That's going to have to be, you can say goodbye to that. I don't know if it's Goldman Sachs, but whoever it is, you can wave goodbye to that. We have to do something about, because the debt was massive on the island.
Trump's comments shook financial markets. The next morning, White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney walked back the remarks, saying they should not be taken word for word.
Dealing with the challenges that Puerto Rico had, the island is at least $72 billion in debt, 120 if you go by other counts, before the storm. We are going to focus our attention right now on rebuilding the island, repairing the island, making sure everybody is safe and that we get through this difficult times. We are not going to deal right now with those fundamental difficulties that Puerto Rico had before the storm. By the way, many folks have not talked about this yet, a lot of those issues are already dealt with through previous legislation called PROMESA.
This comes after Trump tweeted last month that, quote, Puerto Rico, which was already suffering from broken infrastructure and massive debt, is in deep trouble with, quote, billions of dollars owed to Wall Street and the banks, which sadly must be dealt with. In a minute, we'll go to San Juan to be joined via Democracy Now! Video stream by Carla Minette, co-author of the new investigation, Who Owns Puerto Rico's Debt Exactly? Minette, a journalist and editor with the Center for Investigative Journalism based in Puerto Rico, an award-winning independent media outlet that's marking its 10th anniversary this year. But first, we go to Chicago, Illinois, where we're joined by Jessica Stites, executive editor of In These Times, editor of this new investigation. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Jessica, why don't you lay out what you found?
Sure. So we teamed up with the Center for Investigative Journalism in Puerto Rico, which has been doing amazing work for years looking into this debt crisis. And what we wanted to know was, who are the current owners of the debt? And you'd think that would be an easy question, because the owners of the debt are in court fighting with the government of Puerto Rico, trying to get the money back. But actually, this is an incredibly secretive process. A lot of this happens behind closed doors, and it's not at all public who is involved in these negotiations. So what the center did was comb through these bankruptcy documents that have been filed in court since May and pull out the names of these bondholders and creditors that are trying to get their payments. And when we were actually surprised by what we found, we've heard a lot of names floated in relation to the Puerto Rican debt crisis, a lot of big firms. We know at some point Goldman Sachs has been involved, Merrill Lynch has been involved. But the firms that are most active in bankruptcy court right now, we found, were what are called vulture firms. And as Juan mentioned, these are firms, these are hedge funds, and they specialize in high-risk assets, so troubled assets. So they're going into places where there's a risk of a default, a risk of a bankruptcy, and they're buying up the stuff and selling it to investors who tend to be very high net worth people. We are looking at investment thresholds of $1 million to $5 million to even buy into these firms. And although, you know, there are a lot of debt holders, this is who we're seeing really kind of fighting tooth and nail in court to try to get this money back.
And Jessica, there was quite a bit of difficulty on the part of the Center for Investigative Journalism to even get the government to release some of the original folks who bought the bonds, not necessarily the ones who have them now. Can you talk a little bit about that legal battle that that went on for, I think, a couple of years?
Sure. Yeah. Carla can tell you more about that, but I certainly know that they put in, as they should have, a public records request. Puerto Rico's part of the United States. It's governed by the same public records law. And the government basically told them, no, we're not going to give you this information. They cited privacy of the creditors. So the center had to go to court and sue for it, and it took months. And so they finally got the names of the people who had bought this initial 2014 junk bond emission. But at the point they got them in 2015, you know, that information was already becoming old because this debt continues to change hands. So getting up-to-date names and debt amounts has been incredibly difficult.
Earlier this month, Democracy Now! Spoke to Democratic Congressmember Nidia Velasquez of New York's 7th Congressional District, originally from Puerto Rico. She said she supports debt forgiveness.
Forget about public debt right now, the most important aspect, and commitment from my end is to fight to get the resources that we need. If we don't make Puerto Rico whole, you're going to see a massive migration of people coming into the United States, and hedge funds or others who are owned money, they need to forget that Puerto Rico will be able to pay anything. If anything, we have to take care of retirees in Puerto Rico and the pension liabilities. I think that
Should the debt be forgiven?
If there is a way in terms of the authority of the federal government, yes, I will support it.
That was Congresswoman Nidia Velasquez talking to Democracy Now! Just a few days ago. We're also joined by Carla Minette, who's a co-author of the new investigation published jointly by the Center for Investigative Journalism and in Puerto Rico and in these times. Carla, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
You list a bunch of the, especially the top 10 holders of the debt. And not surprisingly, from what I saw of the list, 7 of the 10 are based in New York City. Could you talk about some of these funds? Many of them are hardly household names. Few people know they even exist, except if they're in the financial world.
Yeah, definitely. For us, we've been investigating this issue for the past three years at least. So most of them are not new names, but in some cases, like Decagon Holdings, whose parent company is the Baupost Group, we just knew about their owners just recently because a journalist went on looking for directions, different kind of anonymous directions, and and finally got to an address where they found the owner of the firm. So some of them have been anonymous for some time.
Carla, we're very glad we were able to get you online. We'd hoped to have you on video stream, but, you know, obviously it's extremely difficult in Puerto Rico right now. And before we go on with the investigation, can you just describe the situation on the ground? This is a month after Hurricane Maria hit, and now President Trump threatening to pull FEMA workers out, saying the U.S. can't stay or the workers can't stay in Puerto Rico, quote, forever.
Yeah, well, right now, there will be a month in this Friday since Maria came into Puerto Rico. We have to remember we first got Irma, hurricane also. And, you know, these 4 weeks have been like hell for everyone in Puerto Rico. We are still very stranded. There's electricity for only less than 20% of the population, and water for around 30% or so. We really have very difficult communications using cellular phones in Puerto Rico. You can do it only mostly in San Juan, in the capital. And, you know, mostly people are without food, without water, especially in the mountainous region of the island. They lost their homes. They have no roof. FEMA help has been very, very slow in Puerto Rico. And, you know, we're still even clearing the roads in some places.
And Carla, I'd like to ask you about to go back to your report and to list some of the firms that you highlight in the report. I'm just looking at the list of the New York-based firms, which is most of them. Autonomy Capital, Monarch Alternative Investments, Golden Tree Asset Management, Aurelius Capital, Tilden Park, Stone Lion Capital, and Fundamental Advisors. Interestingly, as you note in your report, these vulture funds are in different alliances because they hold different parts of the Puerto Rico debt and are often at odds with each other over who is first in line in case there is a reduced payout. Who's going to be the first one at the front of the line? So could you talk about this battle between the bondholders?
Well, yes. As you said, some of the bondholders have different kinds of bonds. Puerto Rico, you know, has 18 different kinds of bonds. So in some cases, there are definitely conflicts, even inside some of the firms that own different kinds of those bonds. And some have priority, some are constitutionally emitted. But some of them are not. So there are lots of criteria that anyone deciding who's going to be paid will have to take into consideration. So they are all like forming alliances that have the same legal representation. Also, they have the same lobbies. They have the same public relations firms. So in terms of what the common interest they want to defend in court or publicly, they form these groups. There are five groups right now in the Title III bankruptcy process, and you know, it's a big battle. It's 74.8 billion debt battle, the biggest in the U.S. So a lot of people are having different kinds of interests, and in the end, there are small bondholders, and then at the very end are Puerto Ricans.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Carla Minette, co-author of the new investigation jointly published by her organization, the Center for Investigative Journalism in Puerto Rico, and In These Times. It's titled, Who Owns Puerto Rico's Debt Exactly? We've tracked down 10 of the biggest vulture firms. And thank you so much to Jessica Stites joining us from Chicago, executive editor of In These Times. When we come back again, we find out the voices on the ground in Puerto Rico, what's happening today. Stay with us.
Verde luz de monte y mar, isla virgen del coral, si me acento de tus playas humorosas, si me alejo de tus palmas silenciosas, quiero volver, quiero volver a sentir.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, we continue our coverage of Puerto Rico 1 month after Hurricane Maria as we turn to longtime Puerto Rican independence activist Oscar Lopez Rivera, speaking last week in Puerto Rico. Until earlier this year, he'd been in federal prison for 35 years, much of the time in solitary confinement after he was convicted on federal charges of opposing U.S. authority over the island by force. President Obama commuted his sentence in January, and he was finally released in May.
This is Oscar Lopez Rivera in the neighborhood of Las Monjas in San Juan. He was busy visiting with community members affected by Hurricane Maria. He spoke with reporter Nicole Salazar while riding in the back of a van.
The overwhelming majority of Puerto Rico is completely alienated from the political structure. Colonialism is really, really strong and alive in Puerto Rico. And the politicians have taken full advantage of that. We have a debt of $74 billion caused primarily by the system and the political structure that exists in Puerto Rico. So for me, it has been a very devastating experience, primarily because one of the first things that I noticed was gentrification. We can anticipate that a lot of communities, including this one here, will be displaced once it is beautified, embellished, and probably gentrified. And this is very close to the ocean as a community with a lot of potential. And once they can wipe out the residents, then they can do whatever they feel like doing here. But we can see it in Ponce de León with Ciudadela, where we can see the buildings, where we can see the condominiums, we can see it by Ocean Park, we can see every part of Puerto Rico, every part of Puerto Rico along the ocean, we can see gentrification taking place. And Vieques and Culebras are probably the biggest targets right now. So gentrification means the displacement of Puerto Rico, the displacement of the working class in Puerto Rico, and at the same time, foreigners coming into Puerto Rico, especially because the foreigners who invest in Puerto Rico are having access to incentives that we don't have access to. So if I buy a house tomorrow, I will have to pay taxes on my house, but if a multimillionaire buys a condominium for $1.5 million or $2 million, he will not have to pay any taxes for 25 or 30 years. So that's the difference in terms of advantages and disadvantages. And that's what the Puerto Rico that I have found, a Puerto Rico with a very, very high unemployment rate, and the Puerto Rican that seems to be in a desperate state, especially after the hurricane.
In a moment of crisis like this, a lot of times you see the financial sector moving in, people taking advantage. What are your sort of main concerns right now, given the sort of desperate situation Puerto Rico is in?
Well, the financial institutions are going to move in. You know, they will invest, they will buy out because the property is real cheap right now. A lot of Puerto Ricans are moving out. I am surprised at the number of Puerto Ricans that are moving out of Puerto Rico still. I thought that by now the immigration of Puerto Ricans had decreased a little bit, but no, you know, with the hurricane, it has increased even more. So I see the financial institutions, especially the hedge funds, moving into Puerto Rico with all the force, knowing that their investments towards the future are going to be multiplied or probably elevated to quantities beyond any notion of how capital works.
Can you respond to Donald Trump and the U.S. sort of response to the island, the political response?
I think that is reflective of the colonizer and how the colonizer treats the colonized. He has no sense of respect for Puerto Rico. He has demonstrated it clearly already by doing what he's done. It is shameful for me to see a president tossing things to people who are suffering so much as Puerto Ricans are. Besides that, the way that they came in with FEMA and Homeland Security really reflects what colonialism is to Puerto Ricans. We can see how FEMA can come into Puerto Rico and dictate to Puerto Rico and say, this is what you have to do, this is what you have to do, and be totally disrespectful. The same thing with Homeland Security. Homeland Security comes in and bearing arms. It's almost incredible how they treat people, how they have been dealing with our situation in Puerto Rico. Rather than being sensitive and respectful of the people, they have been totally disrespectful of the people. They're treating us not like citizens, but they're treating us like animals. And I think that once we see the result, because we have not seen the result from the medical side of Puerto Rico, once we see the result, we see that we are being killed by neglect. So I think that it reflects the response of Donald Trump and the U.S. government to the crisis in Puerto Rico.
Right now, a majority of the Puerto Rican population, according to polls, prefer statehood. What do you sort of see as the political trajectory that Puerto Rico is on and where you'd like it to go?
Well, I believe as a Puerto Rican that the majority of the Puerto Ricans want to be Puerto Ricans. Once we become annexed to the United States or by the United States, that we will lose our national identity. I can look at Hawaii as an example of people who lose, the natives who lose their identity. I can look into the Native American reservations and see people who lose their national identity, their culture, their language, their land. And that's what's going to happen to Puerto Ricans. You know, I think that there are times when people think, well, we're blessed with the relationship with the United States, but that is not the end result will not be that. We can see, I can guarantee you this much, if Puerto Rico becomes similar to Hawaii, well, the Hawaiian native population is about 9%, and if we go to the prisons, the overwhelming majority of the prisons are the natives. The same thing with Alaska. So I can anticipate that Puerto Ricans will not be better off by the annexation of the United States of Puerto Rico. I also know for a fact that once any nation or any people lose their identity, their culture, their language, their way of life, their lifestyles, that they are little dehumanized. So you know, this is the reality that we are facing as Puerto Ricans.
I see a big problem if Puerto Rico is to be annexed. But I believe that the overwhelming majority of Puerto Rico wants to be Puerto Ricans. I have been in five different states in the United States and have found young Puerto Ricans in the states who really love Puerto Rico, who really want to do something for Puerto Rico. And for me, Puerto Rico has to be the promised land of all Puerto Ricans, whether we are in the United States or whether wherever we are at, but this has to be the promised land. Annexation, it will never be the answer.
That's longtime Puerto Rican independence activist Oscar Lopez Rivera speaking last week in Puerto Rico. Until earlier this year, he'd been in federal prison in the U.S. for 35 years, much of that time in solitary confinement after convicted on federal charges of opposing U.S. authority over the island by force. President Obama commuted his sentence in January, finally released in May. Special thanks to reporter Nicole Salazar of Divided Films and Ed Marietta, who recorded that footage while filming in Puerto Rico for their series America Uprising, which is airing on Refinery 29. This is Democracy Now! As we continue to look at Puerto Rico's recovery from Hurricanes Maria and Irma, 1 month since Maria made landfall, this comes as residents desperate for drinking water have begun pumping water from the Dorado groundwater contamination site, a hazardous waste Superfund site. The EPA warns the water contains chemicals that cause liver damage and an increased risk of cancer. Our next guest, Rosa Clemente, is just back from Puerto Rico, where she joined other independent journalists in documenting conditions for a project called PR on the Map. This is a clip from a video she recorded at the Dorado Superfund site, where she met a woman filling up her water tank.
Buenos días, ¿cómo estás?
Good morning. How are you? You've come to fill up water here?
Yes, everyone is doing it.
The water doesn't have chemicals, or maybe you don't know?
No, it's drinkable.
Drinkable?
Yes, yes, because it comes from that plan, from the...
But this is called a Superfund site and has chemicals right here. How do you say, in the ground? Did you know that it has chemicals?
Well, it's drinkable. They are selling it as drinkable, and when you fill the gallons and you bring them home, the water doesn't look like yellow, and I use it to drink and more.
I was Rosa Clemente speaking with a woman filling up her water tank at the Dorado Superfund site in Puerto Rico. And now Rosa joins us in our studio. She was the 2008 vice presidential nominee for the Green Party, is now a doctoral candidate at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Welcome back to Democracy Now! You've been in Puerto Rico now for the past 13 days. Tell us what you saw on the ground.
Yeah, well, PR on the Map is an intergenerational unfiltered group that I put together in less than 10 days because I knew no one could tell the stories like we could tell. So, look, the people of Puerto Rico are dying. They want a Puerto Rico without Puerto Ricans. So from contaminated water to mothers who are not lactating to babies having to eat mashed bananas because baby food cannot be found to people getting on ice lines from 3 a.m. in the morning to 1 p.m. waiting for two bags of ice. This is massive violations of human rights. This is a colonial problem that began 119 years ago. And in my opinion, from what we've seen, the government has collapsed in Puerto Rico. And we were able to get to places that the military said they couldn't get to in a Kia and a Hyundai Accent, all the way to Aguadilla, Moca, Utuado. People have not even seen one-tenth of what is happening in all these places.
That's Superfund site?
Well, that's the Superfund site in Dorado. That was a little easier to get to. But the fact that we got to Utuado,
I mean just the site that they're drinking from.
The water looks clean, but the hoses that they pick up are in the ground. It's completely black. We had people, a veteran, pull up to us and said, Mira, pull up your socks. You know, it's chemicals. He said he's a veteran of Afghanistan and Iraq, and he has never seen the level of incompetence coming from the top all the way through the municipalities.
That's an important point, because during the Katrina, there was a lot of criticism of the local government, the mayor, Neji, and the governor. But in Puerto Rico, really, this government has totally failed the local government, the newly elected governor, to deal with the crisis.
Well, 2 days ago, he was at a concert in Miami. with Jennifer Lopez and Mark Anthony, raising money for his wife's fund. He also recently made an agreement with a private electrical company based in Montana that has no record of how to build a power grid. 90% of that island, Juan, is still without electricity. And much of what we see, too, is San Juan, who relatively is doing well.
Let's turn to San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz. Her message to the Puerto Rican diaspora, the many Puerto Ricans living here in New York and Florida, across the United States.
When you are more than 50 years old, you're afforded the opportunity of getting a little emotional. So I will say this the only way I know how to say it. To the young people out there at the diaspora, coño, no nos dejen solo. Usen su voz para que sean el eco de nuestras voces. Without you, we are done. The world will not know what is happening here, because the twists and turns of a man that knows nothing more but to tweet his hate away will take over. And we cannot let that happen. So it's on us, but it's on you. Because after all, we're one nation. One nation.
That was San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz in an interview with our guest Rosa Clemente for the Project PR on the Map. Rosa, if you could talk about that, because Carmen Yulín Cruz has been a target of President Trump for daring to question the relief effort of the federal government. Talk about her role.
Yeah, first, let's just say that 45 is a megalomaniac white supremacist, and that's what we're dealing with, plain and simple. But Carmen Yulín Cruz has become de facto the leader of Puerto Rico. She's also the voice for the mayors that to this day have not received walkie-talkies. People might not understand. There's 78 municipalities in Puerto Rico. That's a political problem. There's 77 mayors, and Mayor Cruz has become kind of the leader of Puerto Rico. She gave us an audio interview the day before while she was getting a respiratory breathing thing because she's so overworked. And that next day, she gave us over an hour, and that exclusive video will drop on Friday. But there have been a little bit of critiques from, I think, people in San Juan who are saying she's going to other places. But when we have more of an extended conversation, we go, well, maybe because the mayors are completely isolated. There is no FEMA. When we were in Utuado, we went to the FEMA location. They weren't trying to tell us where it was. There's no signage of how to get there. A National Guard off the record said, go here, go here. We got there. There were over 40,000 meals that had not been distributed to the people in Utuado, but there was a complete military occupation of that town. And people said, why? We asked, why do you think? They said, there's copper, there's potential uranium in these mines, and they want to take this city, you know, this part of the island for that.
You bumped into National Nurses United volunteers.
Yes.
From the mainland?
We were at a press conference, and they were incensed. It was all types of different nurses.
Let's go to a clip.
How do I tell a mom whose 2-year-old can't stop the diarrhea not to give her 2-year-old water because that's what's making her sick? And I don't have anything to offer them. There's no one coming. She lives up on a mountain using a car battery for electricity to try and put a fan on the baby. A car battery. That's all.
She was
one of the many nurses that were there. One of the things that they're saying is that they're actually fearing a cholera outbreak, the leptospirosis from all the rats, dead animals that's in the water. As well, they let us know that the USS Comfort that is there, that can hold 3,000 patients.
The ship, the hospital
ship,
boat.
The hospital. At the present moment, has 16 people in it. And from personal experience, my aunt was in a hospital in Bayamón. They let me in with a hazmat suit to see her for 10 minutes. And the nurse said, unless you're dying, even if you have an infection that can kill you, we cannot have surgery because we don't have water. people need to be evacuated, and the Comfort sits there now with less than 20 people out of 3,000.
Total mismanagement that is going on.
I think it's more. Yes. I don't think it's as nefarious as a conspiracy. I think that as Puerto Ricans, we've been an island and a people that they have extracted from us, and now they want to extract all of us from the island.
And you have President Trump tweeting, "We cannot keep FEMA, the military, and the first responders who've been amazing under the most difficult circumstances in PR forever."
Well, I saw them partying at the Sheraton one night with a DJ playing the Macarena, hundreds and hundreds of FEMA military everywhere having a good time, 2 miles where people still don't have food and water.
Well, we will continue to cover this catastrophe that is Puerto Rico right now. Rosa Clemente, just back from Puerto Rico, independent journalist, 2008 vice president nominee for the Green Party. We'll link to her project at printhemap.com. When we come back, the firefighters fighting the fires in Northern California, among them a number of prisoners. We'll talk about the women prisoners on the fire front lines. Stay with us.
Nobody cares, nobody likes you, nobody dares to exist in a greeting, a connecting glance. Life is just a jaded game to them, they will give it a chance. But you know, and I know, that the galaxies are all around us. And life will flow on as long as the grass grows and the water runs.
And while I'm Freedom is Free by the LA-based band Chicano Batman, performing here from their new album here in the Democracy Now! Studios. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, we end today's show in California, where raging wildfires have killed at least 41 people and scorched more than 200,000 acres, roughly the size of New York City. The fires are now the deadliest in California since record-keeping began. At least 100,000 people have been forced to evacuate, with about 75,000 displaced after their homes and businesses were destroyed. More than 11,000 firefighters are battling the blazes, and a number of them are prisoners, including many women inmates. In this clip from the film The Prison in 12 Landscapes, an inmate with an all-woman crew describes being sent to fight a raging fire in Marin County.
My first day here, when I first got to camp, I got thrown on a fire. We had just got through orientation, and the horn went off. And I got thrown on the bus, and off we went, chasing the smoke. We're driving up the mountain and seeing dirty burn everywhere. All of a sudden, there's a 40-foot wall of flame on both sides of me.
That's a clip from PBS's Independent Lens, The Prison in 12 Landscapes. To find out more about these firefighters, we're joined by two guests in Fullerton, California, where Marilyn Ralston is with us, of California Coalition for Women Prisoners, the L.A. chapter, program coordinator for Project Rebound at Cal State University. Marilyn experienced 23 years of incarceration. While she was incarcerated, she was a fire camp trainer and a clerk for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. And in Los Angeles, journalist and author Jamie Lowe is with us. Her recent story in the New York Times Magazine is headlined, "The Incarcerated Women Who Fight California's Wildfires." Marilyn, if you could start off by telling us who's on the front lines. People might be surprised to hear that prisoners, among them women prisoners, are fighting California's wildfires right now.
Good morning, AB and Juan. Thank you for having me on the show. Yes, the women who are on the front line are women who volunteer for the camp training program, or they are assigned to the program because they have nonviolent offenses or classified as minimum custody. So these are women who are able to leave the prison and be housed in one of the 43 conservation camps. I'm sorry, one of the three female conservation camps.
And how is it that this program started? Who are these incarcerated women who are fighting fires?
Well, the program started many years ago, I think around World War II. where inmates became involved with fighting disasters within California, repairing roads and sandbagging, floods and earthquakes, things like that. The first conservation camp for women was opened, I believe, in 1983, which is Camp Rainbow, which was formerly a male conservation camp. So firefighting program for female inmates have been around since 1983.
And how much are they paid compared to others who are fighting the fires on the front lines?
Well, fire pay is typically about a dollar an hour while you're in fire camp training. Some folks are paid zero for that training or up to $18 a month. And then once you get to the classroom and you are part of the field training, then that pay escalates to a whopping $48 a month. If you're a swamper, you may get paid $56 a month.
Why do women do it?
Women do it for various reasons. Several reasons are to get closer to their kids for day. You know, those types of jobs come with a huge reduction in sentence. So the credit bearing that you receive for fighting fires is worth putting your lives at risk between the time that you serve. So
are you saying that they get to see their children if they fight the fire?
They get to see their children a lot sooner because you get a reduced sentence. You earn a different credit. You earn day for day. You get to see your children in a visiting area at a camp, not in a prison, where there are less restrictions, where the environment is more park-like. Who doesn't want that?
And Jamie Lowe, you wrote the article, The Incarcerated Women Who Fight California's Wildfires. Could you talk about some of the people you interviewed and what you found?
Sure. I talked to people who ranged in, like, many different sociological backgrounds. I found that their response to the program was anything from, you know, resenting the depth and the hardship of the work because it's intense physical labor to a lot of appreciation for the responsibility of working within the community and doing something that was giving back to it. That said, I think that it was, you know, these women are putting their lives on the line for very little money. They make a dollar an hour when they're actually fighting fires, $2 a day in camp per day. And while the camps are nicer place to experience prison, they're still prison. They're still prisoners.
What surprised you most in your research, Jamie, for this piece for The New York Times?
Definitely that there was a real appreciation for the for participation. I was shocked at how many women were really... one woman I talked to, Marquette, felt, I think, transformed by doing the work. But I think it was also just really hard for her when she described being in the, like, confronted with flames and confronted with the training. It was something she, like, had never experienced before. And her description of it was so visceral and so intense that it was something that just felt outside of the lines of incarceration in some ways. It's not what you would expect. It's felt more like an outward bound experience. It felt more like something, you know, these women are providing a service for the state.
And have any of the women, have any of the prisoners who are fighting the fires lost their lives?
Yes. So that's how I was first sort of not introduced, but that's what why I wanted to write about the program. I had never fully heard of it. And I read a small article about Shauna Lynn Jones, who passed away in February of 2016. And she was on one of the crews in the Malibu camp. There are three female camps. And it struck me that nobody really talked about who she was, how she got there, her background, and how she ended up dead.
Well, we're going to continue this discussion, have you back on later in the week. This is a critical story. Jamie Lowe of New York Times will link to the incarcerated women who fight California's wildfires, has a new book out this week called Mental, and we'll interview you about that. Juan, you're going to be speaking at Rutgers tonight?
Yes, at the Barnes & Noble's bookstore in New Brunswick.
Check it out at democracynow.org. And Marilyn Ralston, thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.